the show. I'm Jennifer Dudley.
And I'm Abby Jorgensen. And this is Fascinating Ordinary, where we get curious about everyday things that are actually amazing.
We're glad you're here with us. Abby, which rabbit hole are we going down today?
Today we're going down a rabbit hole on everyday happiness. It's really ordinary in the sense that happiness is a basic human state or emotion, but it's also really fascinating in that the pursuit of happiness has enthralled humans for thousands of years. Entire industries have popped up that promise us that we'll be happy if we just use their product, but somehow doesn't really pan out, does it?
No, somehow not. I got the sharpest knives that, you know, the Home Shopping Network would allow me, and yet I'm still not.
I have a hard time believing that the Food Network is like, do you want to be happy? Buy some really sharp knives, but we can discuss that later in the debate portion of this, if that's useful.
So this is a topic that Abby and I have spent a lot of time talking about and reading about and forming our own thoughts on. So our plan for today is to present some of those ideas that we think are the most interesting or useful to listeners who wonder about happiness in their everyday lives. And our discussion is going to start with some myths about happiness, and we'll also talk about some suggestions for making your everyday life a little happier. And in the last section, we'll talk about, or maybe debate, the role of others in your everyday happiness.
Let's start off with some myths, though. The first maxim that Jennifer's created for us today is Mother Nature doesn't care if you are happy. And I think this is really interesting because there's sort of an evolutionary drive toward happiness, right? I want to be comfortable. I don't want any pain. I want to have things and love and whatever. And turns out that's not actually true. Right?
No. Well, I want to say I didn't invent this maxim. That would be so cool. But I'm like the maxims themselves, I think, came from an Atlantic article. And, so, you know, like there will be lots of citations in the show notes. And we are definitely not making this up as we go along. For the most part.
Yeah, there's an inordinate number of references to Augustine in the notes that I've seen so far. So there we go.
But yeah, so the maxim itself, I think, comes from one of the Atlantic articles. This idea, Mother Nature doesn't care if you're happy, comes from the fact that our brains and bodies are sort of wired to satisfy needs. Mm-hmm. And because there's a, you know, release of pleasure when a need is satisfied, like I eat food and now I feel good, mm-hmm. that it's really easy to think I should continue satisfying those needs and then I can continue being happy. But the way that that ends up playing out, I mean, if you think about someone, like, I'm thinking of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, if you think, okay, I have satisfied the need of shelter and food and safety, and these are out of order.
I think there's a lot of criticism of them anyway, so I think you're fine. Yeah.
Then, you know, perhaps like the relationship between satisfaction and happiness is a lot simpler, but we live in a world where the needs that pop up are so much more complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my own life and yours, the need is to finish a dissertation. Mm-hmm. And our like brains are telling us, once I finish that thing, I'm going to feel happiness and it's going to, like, I'm going to be changed. My life is going to be changed. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that any happiness that comes from something like that, the satisfaction of a need, doesn't last. It wears off.
It's a rush of dopamine.
Exactly. There are some activities that you can do or changes that you can make to your life that will have much larger and like longer impacts to your happiness. Mm-hmm. Like the loss of a loved one will impact your happiness for a long time. Mm-hmm. But that, even that impact, however much you love that person and however sad it is that they're gone, that impact to your happiness is going to wear off. In the same way that, like, getting married, often people think, well, I'm going to find the person that I'm going to love forever, and once I marry them, my life is going to be happy. But you get married, and then the happiness that you feel from that change in your life wears off after a while. And so that doesn't mean that it wasn't a good idea, you shouldn't have married them. Mm-hmm. It just means that the, like, effect to your emotional state is not going to be a lasting one, and that you basically go back to whatever your mid-level is.
So I can imagine that this ties into what we talked about in our very first episode regarding curiosity, of like needing new things, needing to be stimulated, needing to have the novel, right? The new experience. But I can also imagine, like, what if it's not that it wears off, but what if it's that we just get used to the new level of happiness and then we want more?
Well, yeah. So I think that's probably a better way to say it. There will be articles about the mechanics of these things.
There's a Star Trek episode about this too.
Which one?
The Next Generation, the episode where they get that game. It's like a, like glasses that you put on, and then you try to get the disc to go into the little bucket or whatever it is, right? And then they all get really obsessed with the game because it's like a huge rush every time you succeed. And it's a really interesting episode with some perhaps faulty commentary on addiction and some things like that. So, like, full disclosure, it's maybe not the best example. But that really highlights, like, the two levels of this. Like, being attracted to the novel, but then also the novel becoming an expected instead of a joy or something we, like, take joy from or take joy in. It just becomes, like, our new set of expectations. If there's an element of gratitude missing, then it's gone, too.
I think so, too. And I think, so, pulling this back, I guess, to the everyday, I think it's a lot easier to see with consumption patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in particular, I am the absolute most guilty of this. I love consumerism as much as I am, as much as I am, like, the biggest critic of, like, consumerism and all of the terrible effects it has on so many things.
Mm.
I love to go to Target and buy things and then take them home. And I remember being, I want to say, like, 22 or 23 years old and, like, coming home with an armful of bags from different stores, like, from Target and, I don't know, like, at 22, was I shopping at J.Crew? I don't specifically remember. But, like, oh, look, I bought all of these different things, and I get out of the car and I've got all the bags, and I felt an overwhelming sense of, like, accomplishment and joy. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, look what I did today. This is great. I can't wait to go inside and look at all of my new things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. And it's real. Like, the feeling is real.
Yep.
And it goes away so fast.
Yeah.
And there was an excellent article that showed that that feeling that I just described will exist whether you have spent $200 or $20, or they may have said as low as $5. The fact is that the rush comes from consuming anything. Like, you can buy a pair of earrings that's, you know, like,
oh yeah, I have this about groceries.
Yeah,
sometimes I get bummed when Rasmus puts away the groceries when I bring them home, because then I don't get to see again, like, okay, we're gonna be okay, like, we've got food now, like,
You don't get to savor it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Savoring is definitely an important component of happiness. Like, you had talked about gratitude in terms of, like, extending the long-term happiness from big changes. But I think savoring is an aspect of that, too, where, you know, if you wake up, you know, next to your new spouse and you're savoring the moment of, like, oh, this is my new spouse.
Yeah.
And you might do that for the first couple of weeks, but, you know, 5 or 10 years into your marriage, you're probably not waking up next to your spouse going, like, oh, there they are.
Maybe you're being a little more intentional if you're doing that, right?
Yes.
But I think that's true, not just of big life changes, but of those earrings, too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Or,
yes. Maybe the groceries. The groceries we go through fairly quickly. So.
So this was another study. I should be writing these down so I make sure that they make it into the notes. So there was another study that showed that people who, gosh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find this one, because I'm truly pulling this out of my deep memory.
Mm-hmm.
If you imagine celebrities who are getting massages and going on vacations, having a hard time deriving, like, happiness or satisfaction from those activities, but, you know, ordinary people like you and I derive a great deal of satisfaction, the difference between those is the savoring, that it becomes part of their everyday experience and not something special anymore.
Yeah, they're habituated to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we go do something like go get a massage, and it's different, it's out of the ordinary, and we know that it's not going to come around again soon, so we savor it. And that allows us to get a little bit more of that satisfaction.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it still wears off.
I would also like to say, though, that I think this points to one of the problems with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is that, like, savoring is generally a pretty embodied experience, right? Like, taking joy in pulling out the things that you bought and looking at them, or really relishing the fact, I was relishing the fact on the way over here that my car has heated seats, right? Ooh, that is something that I had forgotten about until my husband pointed it out to me a few months ago, and that's really just a joy in these winters. So the idea of, like, relishing things or enjoying things, waking up next to your spouse and being grateful for them, looking at those earrings and being excited about them, like, that's a pretty embodied experience all those times. And that's one of the reasons why Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is like, okay, deal with the body and then we're done with the body. We just think about the brain now, doesn't really work well, right? Is because it is still, like, we're all the things. We're not just embodied creatures. We are creatures who are embodied. And so the idea that we would, like, lose that somehow is really important in savoring.
Yeah, I think so too. So I think this sort of highlights, like, myth one, that you could ever buy or consume something and it will have a lasting impact on your happiness. Like, if I finally get that car that I've always wanted, or if I finally get that, like, pair of earrings or whatever, that lasting happiness is not going to come through consumption, though I absolutely want to differentiate between, like, you know, if I finally get an apartment that I can afford.
Yeah, a place to live, yes.
Yeah.
There is, like, a level of need.
Yeah, going from, like, any sort of precarious situation to not a precarious situation. You know, if you live in a city where you don't have reliable public transportation and finally you're going to get a car, and that really changes the way you get to live your life, it's not the car that is going to have a lasting impact on your happiness or your, you know, your everyday happiness. I think it's the, like, changing your life circumstance. So I'm not trying to tell people, like, oh, just don't seek anything better because, you know.
So maybe it's not that it doesn't have a lasting impact, because getting a car in that situation is a lasting impact, right? Or getting an apartment you can afford is a lasting impact. But it's that either the novelty of it will wear off and then it won't be happy anymore, or you'll grow accustomed to the new level of happiness unless you really deliberately try to savor it. And so the effect of it won't last. Even if, like, the level of happiness lasts, the feeling of difference, the feeling of now I'm really happy, can just go away unless we're really mindful about it.
So, and then I think the sort of second level to this, and we haven't gotten into it too much, but I think we've hinted, often people who are already on board with our first myth that, like, things, that acquiring things aren't going to make you happy, they point to experiences. Instead, have experiences, go on vacations, go to museums, et cetera, et cetera. But truly, these are not different. You may get more bang for your buck because everything up until the vacation happens, you get to savor, you get to think about it and plan for it. And every step of the way, that gets, you know, that's going to give, every day that you spend thinking about, oh, what am I going to do when I'm on vacation, like, is going to up your happiness. But that vacation will end. Eventually, you're going to stop looking through the photos. Experiences, like things, are finite in how they can impact your happiness.
But you could keep going back and looking at the photos.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
So the maybe the, like, default is that probably you'll forget about it. But if you're intentional about it, you don't have to. There's hope here, right? Yeah. There's hope, Jennifer. There's hope, okay? Dude, like, the vacations are a good idea.
No, so I'm not saying, definitely not saying don't go on vacation. Definitely not saying don't have positive experiences.
Or don't buy the earrings.
Or don't buy the earrings. Yeah. Please go buy the earrings. Take me with you to Target.
You'll never leave.
Yeah, that's right. What I'm saying here is that people who think, step one, people who think if they fill their lives with things they'll be happy, sorry, that's not going to happen. People who think, well, if I fill my life with experiences, that's going to make me happy. And it's like, well, still no. You might get a little bit more happiness than the person who filled their life with things, but that though experiences and things are not the building blocks to happiness.
Yeah. So in some situations, they may be necessary, but they're not sufficient.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so that means...
We sufficiently skipped a lot of Aquinas. Is that
Would you like to important? Talk about Aquinas?
We can talk about Aquinas quick. I think you pulled out some really interesting stuff here about Aquinas's sort of approach to happiness, really talking about how money, power, pleasure, honor are the things that people seek. And in Aquinas's view, these are the substitutes for God. And so without God, you can't be happy. So instead, you try to get money, power, pleasure, honor. And we really talked about like money with things and pleasure with experiences, but I think power and honor are important to note too. So things like chasing more followers on Instagram might count as power or honor, right? Or things like that. So I just want to highlight that because I think Aquinas thought this through a little bit more than I did in terms of the different categories, right? Yeah. So things, experiences, but then also status or influence might be another one. Okay, so I covered what Thomas Aquinas thought people chase for happiness. He didn't think any of those things worked out, money, power, pleasure, honor. It's only God. There are other people who have sort of repackaged the same mentality and talk about it a lot in our current discussions, right?
Yeah, so Arthur C. Brooks, who is an author for The Atlantic, and I think one of the biggest contributors to their... They have like a special section or like special series of articles on like living the good life, that sort of thing.
Which is not the same thing as the happy life, right?
That is true. So not every single article is about happiness. But,
all of them that I've read have been really interesting. So
yeah. And I pull also a lot from the New York Times because they have a similar like newsletter, you know, content
like
section.
Like long form.
Yeah. But so Arthur C. Brooks, he actually calls satisfaction, enjoyment, and meaning the macronutrients of happiness. So instead of chasing power, money, honor.
I don't remember what the other one was.
Oh my God. Both of us.
Pleasure.
Wow.
There we go.
Yeah. I don't know what chasing pleasure is like. I'm a grad student.
You're chasing an academic degree. I think that counts.
So yeah, instead of chasing those things, that that building your happiness around those, the satisfaction, enjoyment, meaning. I, of course, did just say that satisfaction can be a trap, that like constantly chasing satisfaction of a need isn't going to lead to lasting happiness. But having a sort of strategy for your daily life that includes satisfaction and enjoyment and meaning, I think, is going to be instrumental in everyday happiness.
Is Brooks using this as like a is Brooks using this as a hierarchy of needs, essentially?
Like, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that these are like more like a Venn diagram.
So what I would really like is for you and Arthur C. Brooks and Thomas Aquinas to sit down and hash this out, because I feel like a lot of you are saying similar but different things. And the moral of all of them is it's really hard to be happy.
I don't think that's true.
Okay, that's what I've gotten so far.
Yeah.
So help me understand.
No, I think
how
a different way to think of it is that there are a lot of things standing in the way of happiness, but I also don't think it's that hard to be happy. Or rather, I think that there are a lot of things that also can bring happiness.
Okay.
And so in terms of there are a lot of things standing in the way of our happiness, I think a lot of, like, the society that we live in, the things that we are taught to value, and again, like just sort of our bodies sort of pushing us towards satisfying immediate needs and like the release of dopamine, that sets us off in the wrong direction. But it's not hard. Well, I shouldn't say it's not hard, but rather the things that you would need to increase your happiness in everyday life are at hand.
Okay, there we go. So let's talk about what some of those are. We've got all these different approaches that we've already talked about that don't work very well. So what are some of the things that bring us closer to meaning or enjoyment or God or whatever it is that defines happiness for us?
So we're going to be talking about a list that comes from an article, 10 Practical Ways to Improve Happiness. Arthur C. Brooks, thanks, dude, compiled some tips based on a gigantic body of research from a lot of different disciplines, which I think is also useful and interesting.
I have a qualm about this verse. Tell me. Okay, so the article is called 10 Practical Ways to Improve Happiness for When You Need Advice That Goes Beyond Be Danish.
Yeah.
Which I think is hilarious.
Yeah. I thought you would like that.
Yes. Well, as part of a Danish-American family, I think this is a really interesting sort of cultural phenomenon in the U.S. that we've just decided that, like, Denmark is the country that we should all look to.
Pardon me.
Okay.
But this is based on the objective measure that Danes are happier.
Yes.
It's not that Americans just really like the Danish.
Mm-hmm.
It's that too. Science has said that they're the happiest nation.
Yes, and I get why the U.S. is obsessed with Denmark. I'm really obsessed with the Dane, too. That's okay.
Yeah,
but
a particular one.
a particular handful, my family specifically. But the idea that Danes are always happy or that they're like among the happiest or even the happiest people in the world stops short of the fact that Danes are also... Like, Denmark is also one of the countries that has the highest rates of antidepressants prescribed per capita in the entire world.
That's their secret.
Well, I mean, they have, like, no sunlight.
Yeah.
And vitamin D is kind of important to happiness. I don't know if that's on our list, but vitamin D is a good start, right? So, just keeping in mind that, like, advice of be Danish or look at the Danes. The Danes have everything. They also have antidepressants.
No, be skeptical. I think that this cheeky title for when you, you know, quote unquote, for when you need advice that goes beyond be Danish.
Mm-hmm.
The cheeky title is definitely getting at the fact that very often in American culture, we will hit on a particular country or ethnic group and say, look, they're doing this really well.
Let's steal it.
Be like them.
Yeah.
But what they end up stealing is the aesthetic.
Yeah.
And not...
Which is why hygge has become...
Yes.
Pillows and cozy socks.
Exactly.
And not the actual, like, feeling of togetherness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, instead of doing, like, community, they do pillows.
Stuff.
Yeah. Target doesn't sell community.
I want to do a word count of how many times you've brought up Target in this episode so
I'm
far.
Just hoping for a sponsorship. So, you know, and we'll see it with other things like, oh, this country is so happy, or like French parents do it better, and then we'll tell people, like, you have to parent like the French, but we will forget that daycare, or I can't remember what it called, they call it cloche or something like that, the, like, early childhood education is paid for entirely by the state, and early childhood education in the U.S., is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
Regardless of where you live.
Yeah.
Like, if you are having to pay someone to take care of your kid, it's going to cost you.
Yeah. And in Denmark, the same kind of thing. Of like, there is such a low rate of people who are unhoused, who don't have a place to live. There is such a low rate of people who are working 90 hours a week, 80 hours a week, like, stuff like this. So when we say stuff like, oh, be like the Danes, buy these pillows and fuzzy socks.
Yeah.
We're just falling into the consumerism trap again. Okay, so I just wanted to make clear that whenever something says be Danish, I have thoughts that I would like to share.
Well,
and since you're a captive audience in this room, I wanted to share them.
And I think it's also fair to say here that very often when, you know, in, like, U.S. society or, like, sort of the Western culture that focuses on how are we going to increase our happiness or how are we going to be better parents or whatever... Really, what they end up importing beyond aesthetic is individual solutions to systemic problems. If housing is a systemic problem in the U.S. and the Danish have figured out, like, well, we reduce that by offering more housing. I actually don't know what their solution is.
I'm not sure either, actually.
All right. Well, let's pretend for a moment. In a fictional country that we won't call Denmark, they have figured out that the solution to that systemic problem is to offer more housing to anyone who needs it. In our country, we go, well, we're not going to do that. So instead, we're going to tell people, like, oh, you need to work harder. Or, like, here's how to go get a job. Or here's how to hustle in hustle culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep leaning on how you as an individual are going to have to solve your own problems because society is not going to change.
Yeah.
And so that this is a very good place to make that caveat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're going to go through this list, but we... are not suggesting, I'm talking for both of us, I assume rightly so, like, that you agree, that we are not suggesting that any of these items on this list are supposed to substitute things like healthcare for people who need healthcare, or homes for people who need homes, or a living wage, or, like...
time that's not spent working. Yeah, exactly. So, I have a feeling that a lot of these things that Brooks is about to propose to us are going to be individual level answers to systemic problems. And we know that it's not just up to the individual. We know it's not just up to the society, right? We know as sociologists that there has to be an interplay between those two things. So let's get into it. Let's see what we've got on this list. I'm really curious.
Yeah. So first, invest in family and friends.
I feel like that was kind of a gimme.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Have you thought of just being happy?
Maybe you should, like, try to be around people you like and see if that starts it.
Yeah.
Though this does assume that you like your family and friends, I guess.
Yeah, if you don't like your family and friends, then get new ones.
Mm-hmm.
I think this ties into, obviously, that, like, relationships are incredibly important for happiness, for lasting happiness. You know, he doesn't talk about this, but I think some of the reason is sort of the, like, it takes a village.
Yeah.
I realize the it takes a village quote is about raising children, but I think it should be about living in a community.
Or just life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, for you to live your life well, regardless of, you know, like, your family situation, doing so as part of a community with people around you is just so important.
Yep. And we'll get into this more later.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. His second one is join a club. So I think, I know.
Does it really depend on the club?
Like, so the way I took this isn't necessarily, like, I think he wants you to create social attachments.
Okay.
I thought of this as take up a hobby.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah. No, he's definitely talking about social capital from being associated with other people. There's this really cool sociological article, in case anyone is interested, who my first advisor, Mary Ellen Kanishka, with this, I asked her once what her favorite article was, and it was this one. It's called The Strength of Weak Ties, and it talks about how important it is to kind of know people.
Yeah,
like,
that's
to
true.
You don't have to, like, intimately know people, but, like, kind of knowing people really changes things a lot. And I think joining a club could be that. Getting a hobby could also be that. That could also be the next one on his list, so I'm not entirely sure. But I want to say that, like, joining a club is not sufficient for this. You have to actually participate in the club.
Yeah.
Did you know that I'm a member of the Notre Dame Bagpipe Club?
I did not know that.
Okay, so my first year at Notre Dame, which was, you know, a long time ago, I was at the activities fair, and I was looking for stuff that I was interested in to sign up. And this guy in a kilt with a bagpipe was, like, right in front of me all of a sudden. Like, I was just, and then he was just there, and he was like, do you want to join the Notre Dame Bagpipe Club? And I was so overwhelmed by this guy. Like, he was really enthusiastic, is maybe the best way to put it.
I gotta know, how handsome was he?
I don't remember. Oh. I just remember being sort of like, oh my gosh, he's not gonna let me go past him until I sign up for the Bagpipe Club. And he, like, really loved the Bagpipe Club, right? Like, he just kept talking about how awesome it was. So I am a proud member, mostly because I didn't really know how to end the conversation other than just being like, yeah, here's my name. So I am a member of the Notre Dame Bagpipe Club. I have never been to a single event. It's probably a really great group of people. Like, that guy had a lot of great things to say about it. So if you are looking for community and you're near Notre Dame and you like bagpipes, I think that might be a good place to start.
Yeah.
But, like, joining a club is, like, the base level. I'm picking apart the wording on this because I don't think it's very good. I don't think joining a club is sufficient. And I think sometimes people think it is. Like, if I just enter into a social network, that's enough. But it's not. You have to form those ties, even if they're weak ties. You still have to form them.
And so that's why, like, I say pick up a hobby, but to me, the advice here is the intersection of pick up a hobby and join a club based on that hobby. The idea is have something that is not your paid work that interests you, that you can do, and there is a community around it. And that doesn't mean that you have to do the thing in the community. Before I met my husband, I had a very short but, like, non-negotiable list of things that were important to me in a mate. And one of them was that he has a hobby,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't care what the hobby was.
Mm-hmm.
His was kickball, for whatever it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
The point of it was that there's an activity that you're doing, there's a community that can support that activity, that, mm-hmm. like, you can exchange ideas with people, you can... I mean, if you think of knitting as a hobby that someone can get really into,
mm-hmm.
in theory, you could knit with other people in a room,
mm-hmm.
and that would be great. But also, you could just knit at home and then, like, watch videos of other people,
mm-hmm.
like, teaching you a technique and then post your own comments and, like, build community in
yeah.
an online forum
mm-hmm.
with other people who share that activity with you.
Yeah.
Reading is a fantastic one. People
yeah.
don't read next to each other. I mean, maybe at the library.
Sometimes, yeah. But, like, the general way that you form community around books you love is by talking about them afterwards, right?
Exactly.
So doing the activity doesn't have to be the focus.
Exactly.
Forming ties because of the activity, or forming ties using the activity as a springboard, is important.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The next one on the list is being active both physically and mentally, which I feel like relates to this, with also the added point that, like, being active physically really can help with hormones
mm-hmm.
and hormone regulation, which is not something that Brooks talks about, but is something that is really cool and beautiful about how we process stress hormones and how that plays into physical activity, even if that's really gentle physical activity. It doesn't have to be, like, cardio or weight training or something.
Yeah.
So being active mentally, I think, is the hobbies we were just talking about, or
yeah.
whatever that may be. And then physically is just getting rid of hormones.
Yeah.
Or processing hormones.
Agreed. Like, I think very often people have jobs that are either repetitive motions or
mm-hmm.
sitting for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And doing something to just, like, give your body a break,
mm-hmm.
not laying down, but, like, moving your body in a way that gets you, you know, helps you dust the cobwebs off at the end of the day, I think is good and important, especially if it can be done outside.
Vitamin D.
Yes, because of that.
Yeah, and fresh air.
Yeah.
All right, this next one.
Okay.
I have a bone to pick with this
Ooh,
one.
Ooh, yeah.
Here we go.
I can't believe you're going to be... Okay.
Oh, I'm yeah. totally picking a bone with this one. Okay, so the fourth suggestion Brooks has is practice your religion. And it says, this might sound impractical if you don't have a traditional faith or practice it traditionally. I don't really understand that. However, for purposes of happiness, religion can be understood more broadly as a spiritual or philosophical path in life. And I think that matches up really well with the ideas of meaning, with the ideas of God, like all these things that we've already talked about, right? But this is just really broad advice, and I don't know that I like it.
Yeah.
I think that practicing your religion can look really different for a lot of different people at a
yeah.
lot of different stages.
Yeah.
And there are times when practicing religion is going to look a way that might be really happy, and there are going to be other times where it might be really painful. And I think that putting it on a list of, like, ways to be happy kind of misses the complexity and the nuance of what it's like to be a religious person, at least for me. So, not sure I love that.
Yeah.
But I do love, and I do grant that, like, religion and spirituality really give people a lot of meaning, me included, right? Like, there is a lot there. So maybe I'm just being picky about it because it can be a pain point for me sometimes.
Yeah.
But overall, it probably does vastly increase my happiness every day, even if I don't really think about it, because I'm not savoring it.
Yeah.
And I should be.
So I have a very different bone to pick with it.
Oh, go.
I think that the idea that you should search for transcendent truths or meaning in your day-to-day life is good and important, and I absolutely do that, and I don't do that within the scope of any religion. And I don't think that Brooks is trying to insult agnostics or atheists.
Mm-hmm.
I think that still he has stumbled on one of the sort of, like, myths or insults or non-truths about agnostics and atheists
mm-hmm.
that pervades, which is that without God, there can't be meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, that without a religion, you can't have, like, a moral compass.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, obviously, I think that that's false because I'm saying so right here. Because I called it a myth.
Mm-hmm.
Even without God in your life, or even without religion in your life, because
mm-hmm.
obviously those are two different things, I think the idea that a person should seek out meaning
mm-hmm.
or, you know, seek out sort of, like, transcendent truths, I think, is such a good, like, word. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's so big, like, not just truth as in things that are real and factual, but
mm-hmm.
like and not values necessarily.
But something in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's also something that's not parsed out here in this, you know, one paragraph description between religion and meaning that's really important.
Mm.
Because in a lot of the sociology of religion, when people study why is it that religious people are consistently happier, one of the things that people have tried to parse out is it because they're in a group that welcomes them and cares for them and there's a place that they can go if they need something and things like that, right? And so looking at what a religion has meant over time and what it means now, that's really changing. People don't often, like, go to their church because they need a thing now. They go elsewhere, right? So that's a weird deviation. And then there's also the idea that, like, there's one scholar in particular who studies non-religion and, like, non-religious churches. And so, like, groups of atheists and agnostics that will gather on Sunday mornings typically and, like, sing rock songs together and stuff like this. And, like, that sort of association is a really fascinating way to come at religion or non-religion, like seeking out joy and awe in karaoke together, yeah. Right? And that's different. Nobody's done a study like comparing happiness, to my knowledge, between those two groups. But the idea that religion is really interlaced with meaning, but then religion is also really interlaced with having the activity, the hobby, the other people around you who love and support you. I don't know. I feel like practice your religion is really broad way to get at a lot of really nuanced phenomena.
Yeah, I agree. Number 5 is get physical exercise. This is a slightly souped up version of number 3, which was be mentally and physically active.
Yep. So and we already talked about hormones and
But he wants us to have a like purposive exercise plan. Consistent with showing that, like, exercise enhances mood and social functioning. And I'm on board with that. I think that exercise is a good thing. Exercise gives you endorphins. Endorphins make you happy.
Happy people don't kill their husbands.
That's right.
There we go. All right.
So, yeah, I think we're on the same
page. We're good, yeah. All right, so on the note of not killing your husband, number 6 is act nicely.
Yeah, agreeableness, I guess, is found to be highly and positively correlated with happiness.
The heck is agreeableness?
Yeah. So, like, this one, I think, needs all kinds of asterisks. Because, like, who is told to be nice
and agreeable?
And agreeable mm-hmm. is very often a fraught subject.
Yep.
And so, I don't think that act nicely should be reason to not stand up for yourself, to accept behavior that is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really think that, like, don't let the idea that you should act nicely stand in the way of addressing some real issues that you might have in your life. For instance, like, if you have a boss that's violating your rights by keeping you overtime or not paying you, like, don't feel like you have to be grateful that you have a job and, like, act nice towards that person. Rather, be nice to the strangers in your life. Like, if you were at the checkout, you know, at the grocery store, smile at the grocer and ask them how their day was. They do that to you because it's their job and they could lose it if they don't. But your small act of, you know, humanity, and so many caveats. I'm not saying that you have to be nice every time you're in a bad mood. I'm not saying you're not allowed to have bad moods. I don't know. I do think that being, like, putting pleasantness out into the world is a positive thing and that you can get pleasantness back to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But don't let this, but I'm definitely not suggesting that this should, like, paper over, like, abuse or mistreatment. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying women should smile more. Like, nothing like that.
In defense of this article, it's not an article about how to create more justice in the world.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's an article about how to be happy.
I know, right?
In a lot of cases of injustice, people are not happy. But in some cases of injustice, people grow to believe that they deserve whatever injustice exists. Yeah. And then they take comfort in or expect or find that their expectations are met when they're treated poorly. And so the idea of being agreeable and acting nicely for happiness' sake does make a lot of sense if you don't factor in justice.
Yeah.
But we're on team justice.
We are on team justice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Keep that in mind.
Yes.
Okay, but like being kind to people, being empathetic toward people,
yeah,
putting out pleasantness into the world, yeah, like you said. Yeah, that makes sense. Which goes pretty well with the next one, which is be generous.
Yes.
Behave altruistically towards others. Oh, that's another thing. People who are religious tend to donate more money and time and efforts to other people. And so that might be one of the reasons why they're happier too.
Yeah.
Because religion tends to foster that kind of like generosity. So again, another caveat with the religion thing. They really needed that first part.
Is it, research needs to do it. Is it because religions are supposed to be in service?
I don't know that you could really parse that apart, right? Because like so many religions are built around being of service to humanity.
Yeah.
I don't know that you could parse out, like, the effect of religion and the effect of an orientation towards service, because, like, that could be one reason why somebody becomes religious, right?
Well, maybe, or that, you know, being raised with a religion might orient you towards service, but...
Yeah, or just give you the opportunities to do it, right? Yeah, like, all of those things.
The other thing I was going to ask is, like, the organizational function of a lot of, not religions, but... churches or temples or, you know, is to provide services.
Yeah.
Like, so the opportunity to show up to this building and act generously is already built in, where, like, it's not the same with a school or it's not the same with, like,
government
any workplace.
Or,
I, like, religions sort of have their thumb on the scales here.
Is it that or is it that no one else has stepped up?
I don't know.
Like, we don't see schools doing this so much.
I think the Red Cross might.
Oh, there we go. But the Red Cross was a Christian organization. That's why
Red Cross. Yeah.
That's the whole point of that.
Good point.
It's not anymore, to be very clear. Like, I don't know if it is or not, but, like, the Red Cross serves everyone. It's not like you have to be a member of a particular religion in order to benefit from the Red Cross.
Yeah.
But the Red Cross did start as a religious
organization. But I think there are a ton of... like nonprofits, like political or non-political, humanitarian, like international, local, that serve generosity.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the goal is to do something for a group or an individual or whatever, you know, and that you can be generous outside the confines of a church.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, thinking about this again in terms of the everyday, like, you're probably not going to volunteer every day. The most I have ever volunteered at a food bank was monthly. And I didn't do that for very long because that is it's a time and emotionally intensive activity.
Right.
And being generous with your time and emotions is difficult. Being generous with your money, it can be less difficult
depending on how much money
how much money you have, what your expenses are, or whatever. So, like, I continue, again, not because of a religion or in, you know, within the scope of having a religion, I continue to give. So this is not me saying everybody look at me do what I do. Well, yeah, do what I do. And in fact, if you want to know where to give, Food Bank of Northern Indiana.
There we go. Or the Red Cross.
I don't care about the Red Cross. I mean, I don't not care about the Red Cross, but they don't need your money. Food Bank of Northern Indiana, if I'm going to be an influencer. What?
How does Red Cross not need money?
I feel like they're fine. If you can have a billboard, you're fine.
I think that might be a donor paying for the billboard.
Yes, well, it is. What I'm saying is, like,
the Red Cross has
good donors.
Okay.
Food Bank of Northern Indiana doesn't have bad donors, but they don't have Red Cross money.
Okay, fair. But I will also say that, like, this is part of the reason why religion probably makes it a lot easier. Because if you go work at a food bank, that is one thing. If there is an organized group of people that runs a food bank, and they just keep cycling in there once a month, people from their community, that makes it a lot easier to actually run a whole thing, right? So, like, the individual and social that we were just talking about, the individual responses and the social responses, I think that's one of the key differences here in generosity, is, like, if you give to somewhere like a local place, the Food Bank of Northern Indiana, that's going to have a different effect. If you give to somewhere like your local church food bank, that's going to have a different effect than if you give to the American Red Cross or the International Red Cross.
Yeah. But I actually want to pick your brain here because, listeners, I don't know if you know this, but Abby is the most generous person that I think I have ever met. And I have met a lot of people. And she's generous with her time and her resources and her ideas and her emotions. And
that's very kind.
And it, I do think of it as an everyday thing. I think service is important to you.
Yeah.
And that might be where this comes from. But maybe. Like, tell me your, I don't know, your philosophy, your strategy on, like, how is it that anytime someone needs something, Abby has a meal train to set up or a, you know, like an, a ride to offer or...
That's very kind. That's very kind of you.
Did I stun you?
A little bit, yeah. I didn't expect that. I was still trying to figure out if the Red Cross was still Christian or not. Well, I think I am really proud of the work that I've done, given what you just said. Like, that's, it means a lot to me that, like, it matters that much and that it's clear that people could come to me if they needed a ride or a meal train or things like that. But a big piece of it is that I'm just really good at making other people do stuff. You know what I mean? Like,
delegation?
Well, like, when you start something and then other people get on board, you can kind of, like, let it go then. So something like a meal train. It's not that hard to set up a meal train. Like, you go online and you fill out some things. And then the like, actual work of it is sending it to a bunch of people and getting a bunch of people to be like, hey, like, this matters. I think that's how I feel, too, about, like, training folks to support families through perinatal loss. Like, if I can just give you the tools that you need, you could, like, I cannot serve all the families who need a bereavement doula.
Yeah.
But I can help make more bereavement doulas, and I can help make more people ready to support family or friends or patients or clients, right? Like, so I think I just do a good job making other people do stuff that I wish I could do.
Yeah. The pebble in the pond.
Oh, like ripples. Ripple effect? There we go.
Yeah.
Huh. I hadn't thought about it like that. I feel like there are a lot of people who have, like, started me on paths.
Hmm.
Like, you know, the tugboats that pull out a ship?
Yeah.
Like, the tugboats do, like, a little tiny bit of work, but it's the most important part of the work because it gets me started, right? Like,
yeah.
And I move about as slowly as a big ship, and so the idea that there are people out there who will, like, push me in the right direction and get me started, those are the two hardest things. And then once that happens, it's so much easier for me to do them. So that's, I think, because I've had so many people who have been tugboats in my life of, like, giving me the really important guidance and start, and then I can run with it. Like, that's what I can do for other people then too.
Yeah,
that's very kind of you.
I
don't really know how to respond to everything you just said.
Not gone unnoticed.
That's very kind. What was our takeaway from this? I don't remember what our takeaway is from
That being generous, or like orienting yourself towards others in an altruistic way, like the idea of being helpful or being in service of others, I think especially sort of like in a community building sense.
Yeah.
I'm going to add
the tugboat.
Yeah. It, you know, on the one hand, it increases dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin, which are, you know, brain things. But so that's the very individual level increasing happiness. But also, I think, makes your community better, which is going to have, like, a lasting effect.
Again, yeah.
I realize we're supposed to be talking about this in the everyday.
But that is an everyday.
Yeah.
That, like, is 100% an everyday.
Yeah.
Everything that you just said that was so nice about me was something that's an everyday. None of those was impressive. None of those was, like, a big deal.
But, yeah. No, it's true. It's not that you, like, I don't know, ran a marathon for...
I never did that. I ran a 5K once.
That was, and I was nice. Like, all right, done.
Yep. Check that off the list.
All right.
Okay, so the next one correlates with that, which is check your health.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, it is hard to feel happiness when you are not taking care of your body. And I know, like, I know you have experience with, like, your health being an issue for your happiness.
Yeah, I should have read this list before. Yeah.
But, like, I definitely don't think that the idea here is that you can't be happy unless your body is healthy by some of the sort of measures that society has put out us. Like, you are mobile, you don't have any chronic illnesses. Like, no, people who have chronic illnesses or who have mobility issues or who, like, live with mental health issues, like, they can still experience happiness. But I think that an important part of life is looking after your health and like not letting things go unchecked. So having a managed mental health issue or having like a managed chronic health issue, I think is a good caveat to check your health. It's check. It's not be healthy. It's check your health.
Well, the next sentence says, of all health issues, those that create the greatest unhappiness are typically chronic pain and anxiety.
I'll say.
So
managed anxiety does not mean, like, if your anxiety is managed, you can experience happiness. If you let your anxiety run rampant and unchecked, it's much more difficult to live a happy life.
Yeah. I feel like there's a difference here, though, between sickness and disability, which is not really coming across in this, you know, tiny paragraph. But the idea of having something that makes society, like, if society is hostile toward you, that is a very different thing than you are feeling unwell.
Yeah.
And those can go together, but the accessibility issues we see in society today for something like, you know, if you use a wheelchair or if you have anxiety or whatever it may be, again, the, like, don't neglect your visits to the doctor and the dentist is the advice here, but that's an individual response to a systemic problem.
Yeah.
So thinking about accessibility, thinking about what our world could look like if we really wanted everyone to be able to be in it and to be able to be in it comfortably, that would go a whole lot farther than, you know, going to the dentist again.
Yeah, and I would even sort of, like, I love and appreciate that we are not shy about telling this list where it gets things wrong. Don't neglect visits to your doctor. Depending on what your body looks like or what relationship you have to the medical field, going to the doctor can decrease your happiness. And
possibly your health.
And possibly your health. And that, again, that is a societal problem. That's not your fault and you can't fix it. But trying to find way, like, you know, like, I'm thinking about people who are fat and know that if they go to this doctor, that doctor is only going to focus on their weight as the sole driver of whatever issues they have. So they don't go to the doctor. But, like, there are people in communities online that will say, like, this doctor is great. They respect me, like, in my body and are willing to listen to me and will, like, share that information so other people know, like, okay, so I have to, you know, find, I have to see if I can get an appointment with that doctor because they're also in my community. So there, you know, like everything on this list, there are things in our society and, you know, depending on where you live, maybe your city in particular, that might get in the way of your ability to do it well. But I think the takeaway that, like, you should be aware of your own health and interested in managing it is still useful.
Yeah. And then there's the justice question of what society is, like, how welcoming society is to your body, whether it's because of your skin color or because of the mobility aid you use or because of the mental health challenges you have. Like, that, that is an important piece of this that can make people sicker.
Yeah.
Like, it just can. So, all right, we once again are saying, cool, if you're looking for happiness, check your health, but also don't forget that justice is a really important piece of this.
Hopefully people are taking away to some degree that, like, realize other people are trying to do this for themselves too. That, like, I don't know if any medical doctors are going to listen to this, but if medical doctor, you know, like, if physicians that see patients listen to this and they get the message that, you know, I should reduce barriers to people who want to come to my office to, like, check on their health, you know, like, I should learn how to provide care to every kind of body. Like, do that. That sounds like a good idea.
But that's not even doctors, right? Like, if you work at an office, if you teach in a classroom, if you whatever, you can still make that space more welcoming.
Yes.
It obviously has different implications when you are a medical provider.
Yeah.
But no matter who you are, you can learn a way to make the world a more welcoming place to the people who are around you. And that is an act of beauty and an act of justice. And in this case, an act of health.
Yeah. Yeah.
And happiness, therefore, we think. Okay.
Number 9, experience nature.
Why is he so obsessed with walking? This is walking again, compared with urban walking, walking in a woodland setting. This is just a lot of walking.
I think that he's showing off.
I'm just bitter because I can't walk, so that's part of it.
Experience nature, I think, is actually good advice that not everybody can take. People who live in, like, deep urban areas and it's hard to get out of them, like, they don't get to go for a walk in a woodland setting. People who live their life in a wheelchair don't get to go for a walk in a woodland setting, but the experience of nature can be brought into both of those settings. We've seen research that says that, like, having plants in your home is better for your health, like, and reduces stress. So I think there are a way, like, bird watching is absolutely something that you can do if you're in an urban setting.
There you go.
A lot of big cities will have, I can't remember what they're called.
Parks and green spaces?
Yeah, green spaces. Yeah. But, like, even, so that, and then also things like just streets that have more trees on them.
Mm.
You know, and so I had read a book, we talked about this in our bonus episode about crows. Cities that have, like, just tree-lined sidewalks have a ton of wildlife in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously that makes sense. Not, you're gonna, like, look up and see, like, deer in the branches, but, you know, squirrels are really active in urban environments. Crows, lots of different kinds of wild birds. And so that's a way that you can experience nature. Truly, just take up bird watching. Mm-hmm. Then you have a hobby and you can join a bird
club. There we go. All of the things. All of the things.
Yeah.
I do want to say, though, I'm not convinced that this just needs to be experience nature. This could just be experience beauty. Right? Like, if you went to an art museum, couldn't you get a lot of these same benefits that we're talking about?
I don't know.
Not all of them, necessarily.
Yeah.
But, like, the idea of engaging with something cool and looking at something that brings you awe and wonder, maybe even the fresh air, depending on which area you're in.
That's true. No, so I do think, like, experience beauty might be a good one, and experience nature might be a subset of experience beauty.
Maybe. And then walking is a subset of that, because there's just a lot of walking in this article.
That's right. There's a lot of walking in this article. Number 10?
Socializes colleagues out of work. Have we covered this enough? I feel like we've
Well, we talked about friendship. It's interesting that he's talking about colleagues. And, there's tons of research on employee engagement and, like, friendships among employees. But often this is with the goal of, like, increasing employee productivity.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if the point is that work friendships increase employee engagement, that doesn't have to be your goal. Your goal is to be happy. So then your goal should be to find really good quality friends who push you to be a better person and help you be the best version of yourself, and that kind of productivity, not the...
Yeah. So my giant asterisk on this one is socialize.
Okay.
Like, it doesn't have to be... Like, I think most adults think of themselves as having sort of the people they consider family that they may or may not spend a lot of time with, the people that they consider their good friends, which could be one or two people, and that there hasn't been a major push for, like, socializing with people that are not your very good friends. Joining a club or having a hobby that forces you to, not forces, but, like, encourages you to interact with others is a great way to socialize, but... And colleagues, or, you know, like, people from work, that's a good source of humans to interact with. But I think the thing that I want to take away from this that I think is important is when sociologist Randall Collins says that emotional energy comes from face-to-face interaction, that's super accurate and true, and that socializing with people, they don't have to be your best friends, but they should. Like, socialize with your best friends, go out with them, or, like, have them over to your home if you can. But also other people, like people that you don't know very well, like, ask them out for coffee and, like, get to know them better. Mm-hmm. Obviously in a way that feels, like, safe and good to both of you. Mm-hmm. But truly, like, face-to-face interaction with other human beings in, like, a safe and friendly environment is just so important.
But the idea here that we've talked about a lot is, like, middling friendships.
Yeah.
Like, friendships that aren't your best friend, friendships that aren't the people that you would call to take your kid when you have to go to the emergency room or things like that. But also, like, people that you see regularly, people that you care about to some level, people that you would, like, sign up for a meal train for, right?
Yeah.
Like, the value of those friendships, I think, is really underestimated in society. We're not going to talk about that because that was an idea for an episode that we decided not to do.
Yeah.
But I do want to make a plug for middling relationships, or, like, middle friendships, that where it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can be this middle ground, and maybe that will make you happier.
Yeah, well, and like, to sort of hint at that, and maybe if people are interested, maybe if there's a season two, then this can be in it with air quality. that, like, one of the really good reasons to socialize with people who are not your best friend or your spouse or your mom is that different parts of your personality get to come out when you are with different people. And so getting coffee at lunchtime, or I guess getting lunch, if you're at work and it's your lunch break, have lunch with one of your coworkers, you get to be somebody other than the person your spouse has known you to be for the last so many years, or somebody other than the person that your mom has known you to be. You get to show off parts of who you are inside that maybe don't always get to see the light. And that's a really good way to, like, be a whole person, to appreciate parts of yourself that don't always get appreciated. And I think that has lasting impacts on your happiness.
That makes sense. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had some middling reviews of this list. but it brought up a question that I think is really important that I want to ask in our wrap-up here. What do you think the role is of others in your everyday happiness? Like, other humans, specifically.
Yeah, so I think there have been times in my life when I would have said, like, you don't need other people to be happy. Your happiness has to come from inside, that you should rely on yourself for it. And I don't know if it's age or wisdom or
jadedness,
like, I don't know where it comes from, but honestly I've done a 180 on it, and I really think that other people are integral to your individual, like, everyday happiness, in both senses of that other people can ruin it.
Okay, fair.
And also, we humans are social creatures, and I think that we need people. And I think that the way that that looks can be different for different people. That for some people it will be, you know, they, like, see their neighbors, you know, every few days, that they work in an office with other people and they get to, like, interact with them face to face. And for other people it might be that their biggest source of community comes from, like, online groups. But I think that isolation is a recipe for unhappiness. Connection and the other people are really important for happiness. How about you?
I agree. I think, so this was not the quote that I pulled, but you pulled it, so I want to say it. But St. Augustine said that, you said, St. Augustine summarized all human ethics in the dictum, love and do what you will. Because if you're doing everything out of love, essentially, the idea is that you can't be unethical, right? And while you can't ever perfectly love, I would argue, and I think, you know, Augustine would probably agree with me on that, the idea of, like, having everything be in a mutualistic relationship, in, like, done out of love, right? That, and maybe this is coming back to the idea of service, maybe this is coming back to the whole Catholic, like, it is not good that you should be alone sort of a thing, but the idea of other people being integral to happiness, like, true happiness, like, really good, you find meaning, you find God, those types of happiness, I think that it really comes out of, like, being in relationship. Like, there are so many moments when people can find happiness when they're by themselves, but never when they're alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the idea that you could, you would use this example earlier of, like, before we started recording, of, like, creating a piece of art. And if you create a piece of art by yourself, it makes you happy. But that's still, like, you're not alone in doing that, right? Like, the influences, the inspirations, the muses, if you want to use the word that I think artists use. I don't know, because I'm not one. But the idea of, like, everything being done, everything beautiful being done in orientation toward another person or toward a group of people. That, to me, is, like, the essence of service. That's the essence of justice. That's the right? Like, everything we do should be oriented toward the other. And that's not to dismiss self-care. That's not to dismiss the role that valuing ourselves has, right? But, like, if we properly order everything such that our actions are oriented toward other people, how could we not find happiness in that?
Yeah, I think this entire episode has been a lesson in hyper-individualism is not
we're not fans.
Ideal. Yeah.
No. But also that, like, some sociologists would say that this is just a structure problem, right? Like, there's nothing an individual can do. And I do not think that's true. I think people can be in the face of huge injustice and find happiness because of how they're orienting their own actions and their identities and their sense of meaning, right? And that does not take away from the injustice of the situation at all. But I think it's beautiful that we can still find that, because all we need is each other then, right? Like, and all we need is that proper orientation, that love, that care, that empathy, that mutualism, whatever it is. And that gives me a lot of hope for the world.
I think that's a lovely place to end that. So I want to say, listeners, thank you for coming on this journey with us. This is the end of our season.
Yeah.
This is the end of our planned episodes. And if you are interested in more, tell us. Find us at fascinatingordinary.com, on Facebook or Instagram at fascinatingordinary.
Or email us at fascinatingordinary@gmail.com.
Yeah. Tell us if you want more of this. Tell us if you liked it. If you didn't, I don't want to hear about it.
You can send that email just to me, then. That's fine. After an entire season, any takeaways?
Yeah, man, I'm so glad we did this.
Me too.
Yeah.
Thank you for being the tugboat on this.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, thank you. If we're rolling credits here, thank you to Yellow Cat Cafe, where this
idea was
born.
True.
Yeah.
Thank you to the really awful book that sparked this conversation that shall remain unnamed, because both of us were just really mad about the book, and then that turned into a what if we did a podcast, and then we realized that that would be a terrible idea to do a podcast just slamming someone's book.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you to the spouses that, moved schedules around or, like, watched children or whatever so that we could be here. Thank you to the Hesburgh Library
for letting us use your room over and over.
Yeah.
And the staff of the Digital Center who frequently had to unlock it for us.
Yeah, that's right, unlocking the room. Yeah. Thank you especially, listeners, for listening and coming on the journey with us. And this is, I don't know, it's been so fun and exciting. And
if I can pull together this whole season, it really is that, like, being curious is one of my favorite things to do. And Jennifer, I love getting to be curious with you, especially. And it has been really fun to get to share that with all of you listeners and to get to hear your thoughts and your comments and your reflections on things after we share them with you. But there's something beautiful in that too, right? Like, the orientation toward the other, like, being curious by yourself is cool. Being curious with other people is absolutely amazing.
That's right.
And I love it. So thanks for coming with us. There are other people who have sort of repackaged the same mentality and talk about it a lot in our current discussions, right? You said you all you gotta do is just say Arthur C. Brooks writes The Atlantic a lot, and he talked.
I was listening to you, and I was so, like, interested and involved in what you were saying that I was just like, oh, yeah. What is she gonna say next?
It's you. What are you going to say next?
Yeah, what am I going to say next?
You're going to say, yeah, Arthur C. Brooks is an author for The Atlantic who talks about, right?
Yes,
that's what I was expecting, right? You were going to say.
Yes. Yeah. So,